Hey everyone, welcome to the Field and Garden Podcast. I'm Jessie from the Gardener's Workshop. Today I have for you an interview that Lisa recently did over on the Joe Gardner Show podcast. She joined host Joe Lample to discuss the foundational concepts from her new book, The Cut Flower Handbook. They covered topics such as the soil blocking method of seed starting, cool versus warm season flower crops, natural weed and pest prevention, and succession planting concepts for continuous blooms. It's a great conversation as always with these two. So here you go, and I hope you enjoy.
Hi everybody, this is Joe Lample, the Joe behind Joe Gardner, and welcome to the Joe Gardner Show. We have another great episode ahead with a good friend of the podcast, flower farmer extraordinaire and entrepreneur Lisa Mason Ziegler. Today I'm speaking with one of our favorite gardeners and flower farmers, Lisa Mason Ziegler. This is her third time on the podcast, and we are all anxiously anticipating the arrival of her newest and, dare I say, best book, The Cut Flower Handbook. Fortunately, I was lucky enough to receive an advanced copy, so we are well-equipped to reference the book to glean some great takeaways. And availability is expected for all in late February, so you can definitely pre-order, and we will have links in the show notes for that. Now, whether you are into cut flowers or not, if you'd like to have more flowers in or around your garden, this book will be your best friend for everything you need to grow 41 of the best cool season flowers and 25 of the best warm season flowers. That ought to keep you busy for quite a while. What I really admire about Lisa is her no-nonsense, down-to-earth, pull-back-the-curtain way of telling you what you need to know to be a successful flower grower, oftentimes by way of Lisa sharing her experiences and mistakes along the way, like we all do, to become the successful flower farmer and business owner of what we know is thegardenersworkshop.com, which is a thriving educational platform for budding to seasoned flower farmers, which also includes her flagship course, Flower Farming School Online. So today it's more from Lisa telling it like it is and some more of her lessons learned along the way. And one more personal observation about Lisa that I admire. She is in the trenches every day, still doing whatever is needed right alongside her sizable and loyal team. And that says a lot about a person. Lisa, I always look forward to these days having you back on the podcast because our conversations are just so fluid only because we're two passionate gardeners and growers. And then we just start talking, and thank goodness when I remember to hit record, because then we capture a really great conversation, then we share it with the world. So here we are again, and thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me back, Joe. It is always a pleasure to spend some time visiting, because that's what I feel like, right?
Yeah.
Two friends visiting and sharing what we're doing and how we're doing it, and I love it. Thank you so much.
That's why I said that to you, too. And, you know, a lot of times what people don't realize is when I'm doing a podcast with somebody that has a book that I've just finished reading, or I haven't interviewed them before, or maybe we're just meeting, I've got huge extensive notes in a mind map up on my screen so I can guide the conversation and not get lost in the process. But with you, I've got like, you know, three or four lines in there, one word, because I know it's just going to go well. And you have no shortage of things to say that's packed with information. So first of all, I want to congratulate you on this amazing third book of yours called The Cut Flower Handbook. And that's going to be the focus of the conversation today, because as I went through this book, I love it. I always love the stuff that you write, but I like the way you write. But in this information that you've got in this book, it's so handy. And then you gave some of the top cool season and warm season annuals to grow and how to grow them. Very much like I did with my vegetable gardening book. You know, half the book was dedicated to individual crops and how to grow them from seed to harvest. And you are providing that coveted information that we seem to lack so much all in one place. And it's right there from you who have such experience with this. And you just take us through the process.
You know, Joe, I wanted this book to be the book when one of the many things I hear from people is, I'm thinking about starting to grow cut flowers, mm-hmm. whether it's a home gardener or somebody that wants to pursue flower farming. And I wanted that one resource that I could say, here's the book.
Yep.
On doing it, not selling flowers, but the growing, what to grow and how to grow it and how to figure that all out. And yeah, so I'm just pleased as punch.
Yeah.
And I used your book kind of as a guide. Mm. on the way that I structured my book. So that's why they seem similar. So I did. I'm not about reinventing the wheel. That's the secret to my success, right? Is just follow the leader.
Well, I'm honored and flattered that you said that, and thank you. And hopefully that helped you. But yeah, I like it.
Thank you.
Here's to your success of your book. We have, in the past conversations, talked about your beginning days and kind of the evolution of where you are today. But I think for those who haven't heard those other episodes, if we could just do a little bit of the evolution on you meeting Steve and how that happened, I think that's a great story. Sure. And I'd love to start off with a good story.
Sure. Thank you so much. I had just married Steve back in 1996, and he was a gardener, and married him, and he came with this amazing gardening dowry, as it's been called now, this homestead that's been in his family for three generations and had been composted for over 80 years. Ooh. And at that same time, I had just stumbled across Lynn Baczynski's book, The Flower Farmer, the book that I think if you polled flower farmers across the world, that's the book that brought it all to our attention that this was actually a potentially career that you could have. Anyway, I read that book, quit the job that I loved. I was the business manager of a very busy animal hospital that I loved, and got married to Steve and was no longer a single girl paying a mortgage. And so I could lay that aside, but that business experience really paved the way for what was about to come, and started gardening. And so Stevie had big vegetable gardens, and I just slowly but surely squeaked in flowers to carry to my grandma. And my book is dedicated to the grandmas that shared gardening with all of us, because she really was a big part for me. And one thing led to another. And because of the state of the gardens here, literally, I've often said, if I just hold up a seed packet, those seeds will grow. And it's because his grandpa composted this place with leaf mold forever before I got here. And anyway, launched my little city flower farm in 1998 and was an overnight success, and started selling to florists and at farmers markets, and then started teaching gardening to, the master gardeners start hitting you up to come tell them your secrets. And one thing led to another, and started traveling the country and talking. And then I got books. And so full circle is now I have this educational platform called the Gardeners Workshop. .com, and that's where you'll find everything about me, where you can connect for everything from podcasts to blogs to online courses, and of course find our books and our online garden shop. And it's just, I've become a teacher, I think it's like with a dream basket. I mean, I just feel so blessed to have all of these things to share with people and to be able to share them, because as you know, Joe, it takes an incredible support staff to do what we do. And that's the part that people don't see. It's like, we don't just sit down here and do a podcast. We do, but how many hands? It takes a lot of people to make it actually come out. And that's kind of it. So we still grow. My farm, our whole property is 2¾ acres. At the height, which we call high production, we had an acre and a half, and we produced about 15,000 stems of flowers a week. I have no hoop or greenhouses. Everything is grown outdoors. And I think that's one of the things that really connects me to gardeners and farmers, is you don't have to have a greenhouse, a tractor. You can do it out in the garden, like, you know, grandma used to do.
I agree. I think people discount immediately the information sources, the people that are providing information sources, when the way that they do it doesn't relate to the consumer side. And in your case, you're the real deal, and you're doing it, and you're doing it the way that they would do it. And it's just scale or size more than anything else, but the process is exactly the same.
Exactly. You know, I actually say that in the book. It's like, you might not want to become a flower farmer, but why would you not want the tips and tricks of flower farming? But we all start in the same place. We all follow the same ground rules, or we should, because the bottom line is, as a business owner, I'm always looking to do it the quickest, the most cost effective, with the greatest product in the end. And I believe that's what a home gardener would want too, you know? And so that's kind of, you know, what we're all about, is sharing that and just empowering people at all levels.
Well, let's do that now. And in the way you start your book, one of the opening topics is called the cut flower concept. And then one of the subheadings right at the start of that is smaller is better. So that, I think, speaks right to what you were talking about as far as it's just the size of the person's garden, but the process is the same. So tell us about, in your words, the cut flower concept and as it relates to size, et cetera.
Sure. So the first section of the book, the cut flower concept, is really helping people to understand how to be successful. I do say in the book that the most successful gardeners and flower farmers are those that start small and go slow and learn how to do it before you overwhelm and burn yourself out and crash in, you know, 2 years and just never do it again because gardening is way too hard. And we do that to ourselves. That's pretty much self-induced. But that first section is my whole message is helping people to figure out when they plant cool season and warm season annuals in their garden. That is such a common question. And I even get that question continually from seasoned flower farmers. It's like, so when am I supposed to plant cool season hardy annuals, which is, you know, my book, Cool Flowers, is about that concept. But I understand the confusion because it's kind of awkward. So I took great pains to help carry people down that journey to figure out, you know, warm season is pretty cut and dry, right? You wait until your last frost has passed, give the soil some time to warm up, then you plant them and they're going to die when the first frost comes. That's kind of easy, right?
Simple.
But cool is not quite that cut and dry. And it takes a little bit more of investigation, but I am telling you, it is perhaps the most rewarded group of flowers. It's the flowers we all covet, Bells of Ireland, sweet peas. Yes, if you're in the deep south, you can grow them too when you plant them at the right time, which is not the time in that most of us think. Right. I didn't. I actually ripped a page out of a Southern Living magazine probably 35 years ago and had it stuck to my wall long before I was a flower farmer about sweet peas and that we in Virginia should plant them in the fall.
Yeah.
And I kept it.
Yeah.
And that's what led me down that pathway. And that's what the first section is really all about, is about when to figure out when to plant. And then also what is the lifeline of a cutting garden? And that is actually harvesting it. The thing that people are most resistant to do.
Yep.
They're scared, right? Don't you?
Yes.
They don't want to pick that tomato because they're afraid another one won't come.
It's counterintuitive. We don't want to deadhead. We don't want to prune. We don't want to take cuttings because we're afraid we're going to hurt our plant. I just want to point out, I think one of our first podcasts, we talked a lot about cool season annuals and when, you know, when to sow them in the fall and how many weeks ahead of the first frost date.
Right.
It, you know, and it's almost like drinking out of a fire hydrant when you hear it for the first time. It's like, oh, this is like a lot of information I got to unpack here. But on page 25 of your book, you really simplify it. There's a little chart and you can just write it in on three things, fall planting, winter planting, and very early spring planting, and just knowing some key dates based on a benchmark date for where you live gets you started. It just really makes it simple.
Gardening and farming is complicated enough because we make it that way, right? We want to grow 20,000 different things and we want to, you know what I mean? We kind of dive in. So we need to simplify as much as we can, as often as we can. And I mean, it's simple, 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 simple. You know, I mean, it sounds redundant and it sounds too easy, but that is the secret to my farming success, is just simplifying constantly and cutting out unnecessary steps, you know?
Well, that is music to everybody's ears. We all want to simplify. And, you know, some people that kind of sit in chairs like ours want to make it sound more complicated than it needs to be. And I think that's off-putting, you know, but you're the master at simplifying it and being able to communicate it in a simplified way too.
Well, you know, Joe, I totally give credit. You know, I'm severely dyslexic and learning disabled and those struggles, in fact, you know, little did I know that, you know, 35% of the entrepreneurs in the world are dyslexic because we are risk takers. We don't consider consequences and we tend to simplify and solve things. We're problem solvers. And that's what kind of, I believe, makes my message simple. You know, sometimes my sister, who is also dyslexic, she'll sometimes say, "That's way too many words, sister. Say it again." They float off into the, you know, wild blue yonder. And so I attribute that. And I say that because a lot of people out there suffering, a lot of kids that are getting pushed through. And I was one of those kids. If your kid talks a lot and doesn't want to read and write, I'm telling you, and they're gifted. Some of the most successful people in the world are dyslexic.
Absolutely. And
yeah. So anyway, but that's what my, how my message got so clear.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the basics of cut flower growing. And one of the things I want to incorporate into the whatever conversation ensues from here. And so one of those sections I want to get to is the cutting garden's lifeline, the harvesting, wherever you want to fit it. But I've got some points as I follow through your book.
Yeah, let's do that now, because I feel like that's as right there with figuring out the right time to plant. Mm-hmm. These are the things, if you can get these two things right, you can grow anything.
Wow.
Grow anything in the world.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I've got an outline starting with bed size, but if you think that that's a good time to insert.
Sure. So my reference to the size, mm-hmm. I think one of the most remarkable things that I still today, 26 years into flower farming, I am perplexed over the volume of flowers that come out of our small space.
Yep.
So smaller is better. And why that is because cutting and harvesting annuals tells the plant to produce more stems so they can make bloom, so they can make seed, which is their whole mission in life. Mm-hmm. And the more you cut it, the more they come. And I know that is so hard for people. I mean, it's like we should really have a support group. It's like, really, it's so true. Just close your eyes and cut. And we cut hard twice a week. And I mean, sometimes when we're leaving the fields, back when we were high production, you know, we're committed to supermarkets and florists, and we cut the garden clean on Monday. And we're walking in, you know, we're dead tired. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and we're dragging in and exhausted. Yeah. And I'm thinking, what are we going to do for flowers on Thursday? Because we have to cut again for the other customers, the retail customers at the end of the week. And we come back on Thursday and guess what? That darn garden looks exactly the same.
Wow.
And people, because they focus on the blooms on the canopy, but what they're not looking at is the understory that's right below that. It's the backup cast. They're the ones that when you cut that stem that's ready, that sends the message to the plant to push out some more.
Yeah.
And they just push it. They give all that energy to it. And so small means if you know what the size for a home gardener that I recommend is 3x10. Mm. If you go more than 3x10 and you don't have some kind of outlet for the flowers, what happens? Your flowers last a long time because you're growing them and doing all the things that we tell you to do with them. And they last a long time. All of a sudden, you know what? Joe doesn't need flowers this week. Mm. His wife's table, she has flowers in the kitchen. She has flowers in the bedroom. Yes. She had flowers in the bathroom, and she's pretty sick of flowers right now. I mean, it does happen. And you stop cutting them, and then the garden starts to decline.
Okay.
So when you have a small space for what your need is, home gardener small, flower farmers a little smaller than you think you need, you're cutting the tar out of it. And that makes it produce more. So space is huge.
Very interesting concept. It makes sense, but the way that you just said that, I think people can easily relate to. And we're so ambitious. We, you know, especially if we're new to this and we were just getting started and we're on fire with enthusiasm.
Yep.
It's hard to constrain yourself.
Let me tell you, here's a picture, they say that I'm running around with my hair on fire all the time. And that's it. It's like, there's just so many things I want to do and grow, but Joe, I will add here that for me, succession planting filled that need to grow so many different things. It's like, okay, we plant warm season annuals right out of the gate and I plant them. And then the next planting, I plant a lot of the same things, but oftentimes in different color schemes. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? So you can really change it up. Mm-hmm. And then when fall comes, I'm growing a little different stuff. So you can do it if you really embrace the big picture. Don't focus down on one little thing. And you can really, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
And Lisa, these days, is your planning for that more methodical than when you were first getting started? I mean, do you have a calendar and a planting schedule for that succession planting versus maybe when you were new?
Sure. So the first probably 2 to 3 years, 4 years, probably even, I didn't even know what succession meant or was. You know, remember, we barely had the internet back then, right? So there weren't all these resources that you could just ask questions. But what was happening to me is I was going out and planting. Back then, I only had 2 quarter acre gardens, and that's being generous. And I would plant them all right in spring. You know, I plant some things in the fall because I launched my career on Cool Season Hardy Annuals, a fall planted garden. Mm-hmm. Well, that spring, I planted the rest of my everything in warm season. Well, that was great until it all had to be harvested and all had to be sold at the same time. Then guess what? You know, the end of summer going into fall, I had no space. I didn't have any fresh flowers to sell. It was just, you know, it was horrible.
Yeah.
So I learned from bad experience, customers knocking on my door and I didn't have flowers because I was not succession planting. I didn't know that's what it was called. And then I started chopping up my garden. It's like, all right, I am not planting everything. I'm going to wait and plant that place maybe in June. You know, and that just spreads out the work. That spreads out. You have more use of your warm your seed start and stuff, right? Your seedling heat mat and your grow lights. Let me tell you, even 26 years in, I still don't ever have enough space on the heat mats or enough grow light space because, you know, I don't have houses, right? So I grow everything indoors. That doesn't change. So you have to find how to make your little system for your little world, whether it's a little home garden or a big farm, with what you have. And succession planting really is the perfect medicine for that.
Mm-hmm. And to the volume that you're doing right now, you're a big soil blocker, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We probably soil block, I would say 95% of the time. Sunflowers, which is a big part of our program, we do start in plug trays for various reasons. And if you put them aside, we pretty much do everything else in soil blocks. And yeah, I have perfected. Funny enough, I was answering a student this morning. They were commiserating in our private Facebook group about they were having problems. And I just went in and said, first off, you have to know that, and I say this to your listeners, you know, you can listen to all the different people you want in the world, but you have to find what works for you and your conditions. You don't need to apologize for it. You don't have to be apologetic. You tweak it. You know, that's how we learn. That's called being innovative.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Right? So for me, I found with soil blocking in my environment that I can grow incredibly healthy transplants incredibly quick in my small space. Quick is important because I need to move them through fast because I don't have a lot of space. And it works for me. If that's not you, people that are growing in houses, you know, yes, soil blocks grow dry out quicker, but that's why we now have the Swift blocker. It has more volume. If you don't want to use plastic products. So, you know, I think all ways are what your way is the way,
yeah.
I guess is what I'm saying to you. But yes, I'm a huge soil blocker. I love it. And I just love that all I add every year is seeds and soil.
Mm-hmm. And you've perfected your recipe because you've got that down to a fine art and
science. That's Elliot Coleman. He perfected it.
Yeah.
Use Elliot's recipe and it's always on our website for anybody that wants to try that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the components are really important. And I will say that, you know, you can use either peat moss or cocoa fiber as, you know, that's the main ingredient, as it is in most seed starting mixes. And I do definitely lean to peat. The drying out problem with cocoa core, the level of different of qualities that you get has been a problem for me. So I just offer that because you have a choice.
I'm raising my hand to that too. Same thing here. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like we don't, of course, use peat anywhere else on our farm. You know, we don't pot up a bunch of stuff in trays. And because I do soil block and use the small blocker almost all of the time, the volume of soil that we use, that we don't use, I should say, is surprising to people. We do not use because it doesn't take much soil.
Yeah. So you're going from a small block. Is it the 3/4 inch or is it bigger?
Yes. Yes.
And then once it's ready, if somebody were to bump that up, in your case, you're just planting it directly into the soil. Yeah.
Sure. That's our goal.
Yeah.
There is a couple of things that we do bump because we like to have larger transplants. Tomatoes, eggplants, and peppers are one of those, which of course we don't grow commercially. That's just for our own use. But like eucalyptus, which is a super slow grower, it's just better to get them in a larger block because you have to maintain them for so long. But yes, our goal is to start on a timeline. We tend to shave about a third of the growing time off, the conventional recommended growing time on a seed packet, off when we're soil blocking because they grow so much quicker because the roots are being exposed to so much oxygen. Oxygen is as important as water is to transplants,
it
to
is.
The roots.
Yep.
And that's that's the secret, I think, what the real secret is. And also the big struggle. It's pretty tremendous what we grow in those small blocks. And
yes.
It's timing. Yeah. Timing is the secret.
Timing. Timing is everything, as they say, including flower farming.
It's true. I mean, people just starting too early. And that instead of starting your warm season stuff way too early, you should be busy with cool season stuff. That's the handoff. You know, we have to like let go of cool to be able to start warm. And that's just a great feeling.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Okay. So I think we started off that segment of the conversation with bed size and we got into the soil blocking because I inserted that question to you. But as far as bed prep, that was one of the topics in your chapter. What do you want to say about that?
The secret to my success, as I've already mentioned, is the state of the soil that I inherited here, which his grandpa did tons of leaf mold here. They didn't have animals, so they didn't really do manure composting types of things. But he did see the need in people putting bags of leaves out at curbside. They would go out and bring them home, you know, and would compost them to make leaf mold. And so I inherited that. But the deal is that if I had stopped feeding the soil in that way, I'd have dead dirt like the rest of the world if I didn't provide more nutrients, because especially farming, you're squeezing. I mean, that's like sending an elementary kid to graduate school and then not giving them any resources. And so we have been, and then, you know, when I married Steve, he didn't only just come with this great place. Some of his grandpa's piles were still around the property.
Ooh. Ooh.
Oh my gosh, Joe. Oh my gosh. You've never seen earthworms so big in your life.
Oh my gosh.
So and of course I didn't really understand all that back then. All I knew is I wanted those piles gone because you know what I mean? They were everywhere. And so I started putting them in the gardens.
Okay.
Cause that's where the old neighbor said, that's what Will, that was Steve's grandpa's name, William, called him Will. Will would add this to the garden every year. I said, gotcha.
Okay.
Give me a wheelbarrow and a fork. And so that started my journey. And the old guys around here, and I've never really shared this, I don't think, the old guys that lived around who were here when Steve's grandparents were here just sat in their driveways because I'm in the city, right? I have neighbors just like most people do in a suburban situation. They would sit in their driveways and watch me work and give me tidbits of how grandpa did it or didn't do it, or, you know, he would love that, or, you know, I loved hearing that the grandma and grandpa would love what you're doing. And so I have continued what they have started, and we do use organic dry fertilizer, but not nearly as much as people think. And it's because I take care of it in other ways, and we do use it. Really depends on the situation, what I'm planting, and the area of my farm. Some's better than others, you know. But we continue to compost and prep at every flip. A flip is when a crop changes out, whether that's seasonal for you or year to year. We always try to add 2 to 3 inches of something, and that either can get incorporated or you can leave it on the surface. It just depends on what your aim is. And the book talks about that a little bit and helping you with that journey. And that feeds, you know, the workers that are in the soil that are the key to our success, right? The microbes.
Yep. You touched on irrigation a few minutes ago and how it can be tricky. And I agree. And it's one of the top questions I get in addition to lighting. But that is one of the things you called out in your book too. So how do you irrigate, and what are the things you want to add to that as far as helping people, you know, get it right?
You know, we will never sell irrigation because you would have to have a professional irrigation person on staff. Yeah. It is just a can of worms. And that's why I tell my students, and it's so often I have to constantly remind them, remember, what do I do? I don't know a lot about irrigation. I have a good irrigation supplier who I buy from, and I can pick up the phone and call their helpline anytime I need it.
Yep.
That is the secret to my success. So we use low pressure, low flow on top of the ground. You know, I'm married to a plumber, but he has never touched, other than making my water hose bibs, you know, putting them where I want them.
Yeah.
He has never touched irrigation because it is totally backwards from the way that plumbing works. But it's low flow, super easy. It's called T-tape. It lays on top of the ground. Super easy to install. Mm-hmm. But as Joe talks about, I mean, stuff just happens to it. You hit it with the mower.
Yeah.
Voles chew through it. Rabbits chew through it. Squirrels. I mean, everybody. And then there's flow problems. If you don't filter, you have to filter water in an irrigation system because you might be drinking that water, but you just don't understand there is stuff in it.
Yeah.
And so for me, a recommendation of a great irrigation resource, and you buy from them and you just pay to have it shipped, because if you can go to your local supplier place and buy it, but I can promise you there is nobody there to help you
That's right.
when you need it.
Right.
Spend $10 more and have it shipped to you from a place that knows what they're doing. And so that's why I don't have to know about, you know, I have a plumber that can supply the water, which everybody has to have. And then the rest of it is I do what their tutorials tell me to do. And when I hit snags, I know I have somebody to go to. Mm-hmm. And it's super simple to install. You can use it for a 10-foot bed or for a half an acre,
right.
you know, and it's inexpensive because I know that you know this, but it uses so much less water mm-hmm. than what you use otherwise. But we also do a lot of hand watering here when we plant.
Yeah, that was my next question. I was going to say, for those that are starting out small and maybe they are a little intimidated by setting up a drip system, hand watering was going to be my question. The practicality of that, and what do you say to that?
Sure. So we encourage, I think I say it in the book, when you're making your beds, to make a little depression towards the middle, to not make your beds arched so the water runs off. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's nothing more frustrating, especially for somebody like me that's always in a hurry. I don't have time to be waiting for the water to soak in, to water it again, and do it over and over. So particularly if you're not going to use irrigation, we always use raised beds. I mean, when I say raised beds, what you say is raised beds and what I say are two totally mm-hmm. different. They're both really raised beds, mm-hmm. but people think of beds with frames mm-hmm. in your world. Mm-hmm. In my world, they're mounded.
Yes.
That's just soil built
yes.
up because of the nature of what we do.
Right.
So I always recommend raised beds for a lot of different reasons. And so when you make a depression in the middle and you're going to be hand watering, that kind of allows you to kind of like fill the whole bowl up in the bed, and then it soaks through. Mm-hmm. It waters a whole lot more efficiently. So whether we have irrigation installed in a bed or not, we always hand water new plantings. Bobo plants, she rolls up the flower support netting, which we use as a planting grid, takes that up, and then she gets the hose and pulls out. We have 150-foot hose on a reel. She pulls it out and waters and makes sure every plant gets a little good drink because that just gets them off to an excellent start.
Yep.
And so hand watering is definitely possible. Even when we use film, the biodegradable film, there's holes around where you plant the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when your bed is formed properly, the water just floods into those holes. So it's really about making your bed that really makes watering a whole lot easier.
Okay. And then as far as that film, you're a big proponent of that, and you've got that biodegradable film, and you also use mulch a good bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So are those your two techniques for the weed prevention primarily?
Sometimes. So yes, we use biodegradable film, which is the way that I prefer to use for all beds that are transplanted. When beds are being direct sown, which I do a lot of in the fall for direct cool season hardy annuals. That's when we don't have anything on the bed. When we sow, we allow the plants to get up to about 3 to 5 inches, which is what they should get before they're heading into winter. And then we can lay organic mulches, whether it's, you know, chips or shredded leaves. I don't use unshredded leaves in the beds, just in pathways. Mm-hmm. But we also cultivate using a stand-up garden hoe, which I don't see how people survive without a true garden hoe that you stand upright with, right?
Yes.
So I cultivate for several weeks, then we mulch those beds with organic mulch. But for transplanted beds, my go-to is the biodegradable film. It is so useful, Joe. I'm learning, even after for using it for 12 years. Mm-hmm. Now, it's really those weeks from the time that you plant until the canopy gets up and grown to really shade out and out-compete the weeds. That's, for me, where the film really carries its weight. Because to mulch deep enough to prevent those weed seeds on the surface from getting true light to germinate, you got to put mulch pretty deeply. And that's very easy for them to just get shifted and take out a young transplant. Because remember, you know, I'm planting 3/4-inch blocks.
Yes.
And they're 3 to 5 inch plants. They're pretty, I mean, they're nice sized transplants, but they're not going to outfight mulch that's gotten blown over or flooded from a downpour of rain. So yeah, I'm open to anything, but we don't use landscape fabric as mulch, but we use biodegradable film, organic mulches, and cultivation, surface cultivation.
Now that film, is that practical for somebody that has a smaller size bed? I know that you have an implement on the back of your tractor, I think, that spreads that out now, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but the first 4 years, I did not have that tractor, and we actually had 120-foot beds back then. So me and two gals were really very good at that. It definitely takes time. That was, I mean, but that, you know, that's all part of the journey, right?
Yep.
But yes, it is incredibly useful in small gardens, because you can, I tell you another really useful part of using film is I can make beds and prepare them completely and then cover them with this film and tuck it in just like you're making a bed and leave it unplanted and not worry about light getting to the weed seeds on the surface. So when the weather's right and my timing is right, I can prepare beds and then they can sit there for 3 weeks and get no, you know, no growth from sunlight or even water getting through to it. So yes, home gardeners and flower farmers alike, it's very easy to do. And we actually have a video showing how to do it on the product page on our website.
And while we're talking about that, we are going to have links to everything Lisa's talking about in the film, where you can get that on her site, and the videos and all of that. So gardenersworkshop.com is the direct link, isn't it?
Yes.
And then you can go
from
there. But we'll have that and other related links, pictures of Lisa's farm and all that stuff. So you'll definitely want to check out the show notes. But yeah, that's good to know. And then another application that you do, you know, a lot of us that are starting flowers quickly discover that the stems aren't as upright as we would like them to be. And you've got some techniques for that that really work.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't a user of flower support netting or just support of, there's lots of different ways to do it. But as a commercial grower or specific cutting gardens, it's just easier and more economical to go with support netting. But not only, I mean, stems typically will actually start growing in the right direction, but it only takes one torrential downpour to lay them down and they'll never be back.
Wow.
And so when a flower lays down, like snapdragons, oh my gosh, if you don't get to them almost immediately before the sun hits them, all their tips are turned up.
Ooh.
Never going to be fixed. So it's a total loss as a cutting garden, right? So we have learned that offering support at the proper time in the growth, which means we typically support plants at their halfway to maturity mark. So if a plant's going to grow 48 inches, like a zinnia, then the netting would be supported at 24 inches, kind of like bracing you at your hips.
Yes.
Where if you do it at the right spot, they can pretty much, they won't take a hurricane, but we've taken 50 and 60 mile an hour winds with netting and had flowers, some survive. You know, it can actually work. And so using flower supporting is needed. I mean, especially like think coxcomb and zinnias, they fully open in the garden to be used as a cut flower. Their canopy gets really heavy really quickly, and it doesn't take much to take them down. So flower support netting, and there's lots of different ways. I mean, you can find at your local garden center grow-throughs, those green wire meshes that they can grow up through. Like I would put that on a peony. If I had peonies, you better believe I'd have those in my landscape for those. But in a cutting garden where you have a long, narrow bed, flower support netting, which is what we use, is super economical, reusable from year to year, and does a great job.
And does that go on after you do the transplanting of the seedlings and then you install that?
Sure, that's a good question. So the goal is to get it in before the plants reach that half to maturity size, right? So that they naturally just grow through the netting.
Right.
For us, we typically, I mean, because we're pretty much overcome all the time, right? With work that needs to be done. Our goal is to plant and then get the netting in as soon as possible after that, before it reaches that. And sometimes there's actually a picture in the book of a whole garden of cool flowers that never got netted. I mean, every rainstorm, I was like, chewing my nails at the window. It's like it takes away that worry that you have, but it happens. But that's the goal. Get it in. I would say if you are a home gardener or a small grower, plant and get it in. You would not net cool season hardy annuals planted in the fall until the following very early spring. You wouldn't leave that up all winter. Yeah. But once the season starts, you net as soon as possible.
Are there special stakes for that, or just you just use what you have?
Well, no, you strong stakes. The netting will support pretty much anything I have ever challenged it with, mm-hmm. from super tall, top-heavy sunflowers that were used for big heads, you know, not for cut flowers. It's the stakes or the weak link. I use two different things, either metal T-posts, which really are the preferred. Yep. They're just expensive if you need a volume of them.
But you buy them one time.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I have some that I bet are 50 years old that were here on this farm.
Yeah.
So T-posts are the greatest, and you don't need them to be super tall. I'm like 36 to 48 inches. And then I also buy a pallet every 2 or 3 years of 2x2 or 1.5 by 1.5 oak stakes from like a landscape supply place. Mm-hmm. They use them for staking trees. So it just depends on what, you know, we used to use literally thousands of stakes.
Wow.
And so T-post was what we would use at the head and the foot, and we'd fill in the sides with wood. So yeah, your netting is only as strong as your stakes. And I am one mean sludge hammer driving stake person.
I saw that. I have a question about that. In your book, there's a picture of you with a full size sledgehammer with the long handle on it. Have you tried just the hand size?
No? The bigger, the heavier the sledgehammer, the easier it is. And I don't remember what the picture looks like, but my method of madness is I put the sledgehammer on my foot. You know, that's where I hold it while I'm getting the stake and putting it in the netting in the right place. And then I reach down and grab the sledgehammer about 6 or 8 inches away from the head and lift it up. And then I tuck the handle underneath my arm.
Okay.
So that kind of helps me. And then I can beat it in. And the heavier the sledgehammer, the easier it is to hit it in. But of course, you have to be able to lift it. And so, you know, my limit now as a 62-year-old is I can probably do about 30 to 40 posts at a time. Mm-hmm. And I'm out there at the crack of dawn by myself, not talking to people, focusing and getting it done, because it's a really important job. And a pile driver, because there'll be people that reach out to you and to me to say, you do know that there's stake drivers.
Yeah.
It is very difficult to keep the stake with the netting on it, keep it aligned properly.
Right.
That's the problem with that. So anyway, but it's a good workout.
It's a great workout. Your biceps are quite impressive in those pictures. But the other thing is I think the reason why that can work for almost anybody is the fact that those stakes aren't so high that you're having to lift the weighted part of that sledgehammer above your shoulders or whatever. It still makes it easy for you.
That's such a great point, Joe, because I used to get 60-inch, 5-foot stakes thinking I needed that. We had to cut them all off because that was the secret.
Yeah.
We used to take a 5-gallon bucket and turn it upside down in the garden to stand on to drive the stakes. And it's like one day Steve finally said, why does it need to be that tall? And I'm like, well, that's a great question, babe. You're right. Let's buy shorter ones. Sometimes you just can't see the trees or the forest.
Amen. That's so true. Well, let's talk about one last thing I had on my list, and that's just what are your methods for the pest and disease management?
You know, I'm just such a big believer in a healthy environment is the real kickstarter. You know, Jenny Love and I talk about that. She's the no-till flowers gal.
Yeah.
And she has really made it. Her evidence has just affirmed my theory that when you really provide a super healthy environment, and that means super healthy transplants, she and I are both believers. Those first 2 weeks of life are really, really important. Mm. If you have a puny transplant, they're going to be the ones that fall victim.
Mm.
You know, they're not as resilient as others are.
Yeah.
Then planting healthy plants into incredibly well-draining, healthy, nutritious soil makes another part. And then the rest of the story is, you know, if you're buggy in my environment, you know, you're out of here. I write in the book about a really popular cut flower that amaranth, which is a gorgeous. There's a whole bunch of different ones that's gorgeous, but they are flea beetle magnets. Oof. On my farm. Those leaves look like lace work. Mm. And you just can't control them. I don't grow amaranth.
Okay.
We don't have flea beetles anywhere on my farm. Mm. You know, and we grew it for the book to have pictures. And it's going to take me 2 years, 2 to 3 years to recover from that. So your healthy environment and then crop selection. Mm. If there is something that's a problem, you need to get rid of it at least until you restore the natural order of your garden and then find the least impactful way to perhaps, I mean, we hand pick Japanese beetles and stink bugs, but we just really encourage, you know, the good guys, and we let them kind of duke it out. We do not use pesticides, organic or otherwise, and do not find it necessary.
Right.
I used to have a lot of pest issues back in the beginning, but when you focus on the important part, you know, what you're standing on and healthy start to life and nurturing them, giving nature a hand, mm-hmm. instead of having a better idea than she did.
Yes, there isn't one.
But exactly.
Yeah. No, you restore the biodiversity with that nice selection of flowers that you have. There's a lot of beneficials coming in, and you're not, you know, disrupting the natural systems when you're throwing out pesticides. And the other thing I wanted to say is good words of wisdom on your part in reminding people that, you know, you don't have to feel compelled to grow something just because you planted it and have the courage to cull it.
You know, I mean, that is the hardest, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, funny enough, right now downstairs, my garden cart is full of all these transplants that we started over the winter for photography. You know, the most beautiful tomato transplants and peppers. It took me forever to just finally put them in the cart and tell Bobo, take them to the compost heap. And I walked past them this morning. They look so sad, but it's like they did their job, you know, and sometimes when you run into a problem, you know, I have been known to mow beds, you know, a bed that doesn't get netted, that's just a blooming mess. It's like, this is torturing me to see, you know, all those dollar bills standing out in the garden that causing us problems. Let's just end it. And yes, you get rewarded because guess what? Then we got to plant something else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, so.
There's something about wisdom coming with time and experience. And
yep, it does get easier. I can be your cheerleader.
Yeah, mow you it. Are. Yeah.
Cut it down. It'll be okay.
And I have to chuckle because you just mentioned that cart full of tomato seedlings. And in my greenhouse right now, I probably have 500 picture perfect heirloom tomato varieties of a favorite variety, pineapple.
Joe, you bad boy.
I know. Well, I was doing the same thing you were, though, for testing and trialing and mm-hmm. pictures. And now I don't know what to do, and I don't have the heart. I'm not there yet, Lisa, in culling them. I'm going to try to.
We can talk tough. I have some peppers downstairs. I have, I think it's probably 16 pepper plants, the bell pepper seed that we sell, Olympus. And we grew them, and I thought this morning I came in, I thought today's the day. I'm taking them out of here. And I thought, you know what? No, I bet I could make a video pull because they're in 2-inch soil blocks. The roots are magnificent.
Yeah,
I thought, I'm making a video showing me pulling those babies apart. They're going to have they're going out in style.
Okay.
But, you know, I can talk the talk, but I'm not always so tough. You know, ask Bobo. She is quicker than I am.
Okay.
Bobo works with me here. She's really, really quick to clear things out, and she'll be so happy to see that cart. I mean, there's probably 2,000 plants down there. They're all goners now.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were just extras, overages, and demonstration plants.
That's
and that's
happens.
Part of our job now.
Yeah.
That was their purpose in life.
Yep. I'm getting there, Lisa. I'm getting there. I'm getting better at it, but it's still never easy. It's like pruning.
But you know what? I think the message in my book really drives that home. Like, keep cutting, pull it out.
Yep.
You know, and also, you know, incorporating succession planting and knowing that you can pull out a crop. Succession planting means you should always kind of have seedlings in the wings.
Yeah.
Looking for a home. Yeah. And that gives you the might and the power to go out there and say, it's been real bad. You're out of here. You know, you've done your job.
Yeah.
And I will say that oftentimes Steve, my husband, does the mowing down. I can't quite bring myself to do it. But it's just part of that cycle. That's like seeing a hawk get an animal, right? You know, they have to eat too. And but I don't need to see it necessarily.
Yeah. This has been fantastic. As always, you're a wealth of information, and you have no problem connecting the dots. And we love you for that. And thank you so much. And I'm so excited for your success on this book. It's clearly a winner.
Sure. And, you know, being able to include 66 flowers and feature all like I copied from Joe. Followed his outline, those crop features, really, the featured pages.
Yeah.
I think I've already heard from people like you that got the book ahead of time that it's like, what great tips. Yeah. I mean, to be able to include that, right? I mean, that's just really, really helpful. So yeah, we're really excited about the book coming out, and it is available for pre-order, and we have some special bonuses for you.
Okay. Well, we'll send our listeners right to that website for those bonuses and to pre-order. And Lisa, all the best to you. I know you've got a busy year ahead, and we'll touch base as we're able.
All right, Joe. Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about anything.
Yeah, same here.
Okay, welcome back. If you'd like to listen to the full original episode over on Joe Lample's website, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. You'll find links there to other topics they mentioned as well, including Lisa's new book. So that's all for today, flower friends. If you'd like what you're hearing here on the Field and Garden podcast, we'd love it if you'd tell a friend about us and leave a review for us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Jessie from the Gardener's Workshop, and I hope you have a great day.